Thank you for selecting this message by Dr. James Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman preaches verse by verse through the entire book of the Bible. From all of us at Living Water of La Pine here in Central Oregon, we hope that it will encourage you and feed you spiritually. And if you would like to leave a message after the sermon, our contact information is found on the sermon page where you found this sermon. Now may God richly bless you as you listen.
Have you been noticing lately that so many products that are out there on the market today are designed to imitate something else that's real? Well, there is, for example, plastic decking that looks like real wood. We have vinyl flooring that appears as ceramic tile. Well, we also have ceramic tile that you can lay in your kitchen that looks like wooden planks. We can purchase fake fur, jewelry, phony noses, hair pieces, and other body parts. Now, the purpose behind all of these items seems fairly obvious. But what about a can of spray-on mud? It's true. There is a product that is actually sold today, and it is spray-on mud. It's designed to be used on the outside of your SUV, and that way it appears as if you have used your expensive gas guzzler for more than taking kids to soccer practice. Just on the label here, I put an example of the label up here for you to see what it says on the back of this bottle here. It says, spray-on mud is a specially formulated spray-on product for anyone that wants to give friends, neighbors, colleagues, or just anyone at all the impression that they have been off-road or at the very least out in the country for a weekend. Wow. And I was reading that the product sales are going very well here in America and in London where it was first developed. Its inventor, Colin Dow, says if they want an authentic look, there's not a lot else they can do. There's not a lot of mud in Chelsea, England. Apparently a $15 can seems a reasonable price to pay for authenticity. And then this week I was watching my morning news program, and apparently Nordstrom's is selling a pair of jeans for $425 that has mud, plastic mud, on them for you, giving the public the impression that you are quite the outdoors person. Incredible. And the reviews are coming in on it. Some of these reviews are quite hilarious that people are saying. For example, these are great. Now that I'm unemployed and I can still look unemployed with minimal effort, it's a bit pricey for a derelict like me. Being pregnant and on welfare, but still a super product. Great look with zero effort. Best jeans I ever bought. They fit like freedom, smell like America, and wear like steel. They fill that niche in my wardrobe that I've been looking for. The look that says, hey, I'm a man who does stuff. I build things with my hands. I rotate my own tires. I stand up for what I believe in without throwing tantrums. I'm a man of times past, only without having to do or be any of those things. Incredible. Well, the reviews get funnier and funnier. I'm not going to read them all for you. You get the idea of what I'm pointing out here. This authenticity, being fake today, is incredible. To what extent even fake mud on your jeans? Wow. Well, Well, just like normal American society today, there are so many expressions of imitation Christianity. You can read on Facebook, I'll be sending good thoughts your way. It says, if good wishes are being mistaken for true prayer. And then success is automatically interpreted as spiritual blessing or as spiritual achievement. Inspirational bumper stickers and symbols can be seen as evangelism. Just put the message on your car, wear it on your shirt. Excellent music could be a cover for authentic worship of the heart. Humorous or emotional stories can pass for inspired preaching. Christian cliches can be handed out as biblical wisdom. An attractive personality can be mistaken for a spirit-filled life. Last week, we began a section of our study through the Gospel of Matthew, which is known as the Sermon on the Mount. And last week, we discovered that Jesus is declaring what kingdom life is like for every true believer. This is authentic spiritual life of the believer. And everything else is imitation Christianity. Listen, you know what I'm about to tell you is true. The number one cause of atheism is Christians. Those who proclaim God with their mouths and deny him with their lifestyles is what an unbelieving world finds simply unbelievable. We might think that we're pretty good imitators of authentic spiritual living, but it's driving people away from the Lord. I believe that in most cases of unbelief, it is not an intellectual persuasion of God's non-existence. It is Christians who live as though God doesn't really exist. They replace authentic spirituality with imitation Christianity. Or they pretend that their faith doesn't need any to change their life at all. It doesn't need to affect them in their day-to-day living. As I was preparing for today's message, a writer of one of the commentaries that I was using to prepare for it, just as if he just stopped in the middle of his thought and began to talk about his upbringing. And he went on to write this. He said, until my conversion in 1975, I professed to be an atheist, in part because I looked at the roughly 85% of my fellow U.S. citizens who claimed to be Christians and could not see that their faith genuinely affected their lives. I reasoned that if even Christians did not believe in Jesus' teaching, why should I? My excuse for unbelief, and the excuse of many other secularists I knew, continued until God's Spirit confronted me with the reality that the truth of Christ does not rise or fall on the claims of his professed followers, but on Jesus himself. The faith of nominal Christians may appeal to non-Christians who can use it to justify their own unbelief. But such Christians will be thrown out and trampled. And that's the point our opening verse in our passage today makes. Matthew 5, verse 13. The Sermon on the Mount is of tremendous value to us because we get a picture directly from Christ that will show us if we are the real deal or simply imitations. The portion of the Sermon on the Mount that we come to this morning deals with the matter that the faith of a kingdom person does genuinely affect our life. You see, faith is not one's own personal matter. In sharp contrast to the many Christians around the world who live under the constant threat of torture and death, Western Christians often remain silent in public life. Simple fear of ridicule and derision has silenced them and said, oh, my Christianity is just a matter of my own private life. They don't witness in the workplace. They do not intend to reveal the fact that they are Christian. Even within the sacred walls of the churches, they very often attend in mute salutation of their meager faith, silenced by a mammoth media that breeds a contemptuous, begrudging view of those of us who are born again. Some Christians go through life believing that silence and anonymity is appropriate as camouflage. No one will ever discover that they're a Christian. And to them, that's okay, because they mistakenly believe that faith is a private matter. Now, in light of today's opening verses of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, the call of Christ is clear. This message from Christ is not open for debate. He has laid down the distinguishing characteristics of the people who belong to his kingdom. Keeping our faith hidden and private is foreign to any person who is part of the kingdom of God. Let's read how Jesus phrased that. Matthew chapter 5, beginning with verse 13. Verses 13 through 16. You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Now, here in this sequel to the Beatitudes, which we studied last week, the Lord gives two illustrations to show what we are will have an impact on what others do. We, who are salt of the earth and light of the world, are living in a world of decay and darkness. And we are to have an impact on both conditions. Our function as salt is to resist decay. Salt is aseptic. It cannot change corruption into incorruption, but it does prevent corruption from spreading. It is used to hold decay and putrefaction at bay. Before the days of refrigeration, it was the most commonly used preservative. I'm fascinated by the way that God has designed our oceans. He's designed them to be salty for a reason. It's a miraculous filter that purifies both air and water, our entire earth. As rivers drain into the ocean, salt corrodes and breaks down the pollutants that flow into it, and then pure water particles evaporate into the sky and drop back to the earth as much cleaner water. The salt from the spray of an ever-churning ocean gets picked up by the wind. It becomes airborne. Air-polluting particulates glom onto the salt particles, and they fall back to the earth. High winds take salt from the sea high into the air, way far inland. So the earth's air and water supply are constantly cleansed and refreshed because of the salt in the oceans. We could not live on this planet without that salt in the ocean. Salt has many functions. I just want to point out a few of those to you. What an analogy for Christ to say, we are salt. First, salt sanctifies. Without the saltiness, the oceans would be great areas of corruption that would plague the earth with disease. When the godly show up in a room, people often want to clean up their language and behave better. Holiness influences and promotes purity of conduct. The second, salt saves or preserves. Salt is a great preservation of good. Until refrigeration advances occurred in our time, salt was the chief ingredient for preserving food. The godly can preserve a nation and save a society from great judgment. We have already noted that they could have done that in Sodom. Third, salt seasons. Salt can greatly improve the flavor of food. The presence of the godly will encourage, they'll inspire, they'll help. Christians should not be deadbeats. Should not be moody, always complaining, always unpleasant. Christians should be salt, not vinegar. Timothy Keller makes the following observations about salt. I like what he writes here. He says this. The job of salt was to make something taste good. I don't know about you, but I can't stand corn on the cob without salt on it. When I've eaten a piece of corn on the cob that I really like, I put it down and what do I say? That was great salt! No, I say that was great corn on the cob. Why? Because the job of the salt is not to make you think how great the salt is, but how great the thing is with which it is involved. What if you are salt in your small group Bible study? If you're salt, people will not go away saying, that person really knows the Bible and had all the answers. Showed me up. No. What happens is when you go away from a small group in which you have been the salt, people don't say how great you were. They say, what a great group. What fascinating truth. That is pretty simple. Salt makes you feel better about life. Christians make you feel better. But religious people always make you feel condemned. They make you feel worse. Jesus added a warning at the end of verse 13. Take a look at it here. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. The statement, of course, does not refer to losing one's salvation, but to losing one's testimony and influence. This pictures the disabling work of sin in regard to a Christian's service and testimony. As an example, when a minister commits adultery, he's done. He'll never again regain his seasoning. The stigma will never be completely removed in his life. The failure will plague him the rest of his life. Same holds true for every believer and their witness for Christ. If ever there was a day when the earth needed Christians to keep their testimony and influence, it is this day of X-rated home movies, internet pornography, and the marching sodomite. Verse 14. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. While salt deals with the moral, light deals with the spiritual. Salt relates to our character, but light relates to our conduct. Salt deals with what a person is. Light deals with what a person does. Jesus said in John 9:5, I am the light of the world, but here he says, you are the light of the world. Now, taken together then, the two statements mean we are to be like him. We are to remind people of the existence and the authority of God by living in the will of God and being like Jesus. Just as a city that is set on a hill cannot be hid, our testimony for God must be consistent, continuous, and conspicuous. This should put to rest any notion that Christian faith is merely a private matter between a person and God. It isn't. Christian faith is not a personal or private matter. Verse 15. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. Christ gives two patterns to emphasize that the believer is to shine conspicuously. First, the city on the hill. A city on the hill is more conspicuous than a city anywhere else. Christians should shine so conspicuously that no one would doubt that they are Christians. Second, a lamp in the house. The small wicker oil lamps of this period gave little light to the average first century home, which had few windows. Lamps or candles would be most effective by being set on a lampstand. Something large placed over them would presumably extinguish their light altogether. A lamp that has been lit, or a candle if you prefer, is to be put on the lampstand, raised up where it could shed light to the entire room. The light must be very conspicuous or it's of little use. Here is the point. Your Christian profession must show in obvious ways. Unless you're only an imitation. Verse 16. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. If your spirituality is authentic, it will glow like lights, showing others what Christ is like. If we are imitations, our consistent lifestyle will be to hide our light, being quiet when we should speak. Going along with the crowd, denying the light, letting sin dim our light. Not explaining our light to others. Or ignoring the needs of others. Be a beacon of truth. Don't shut your light off from the rest of the world. Author of an article in Christianity Today magazine. I tried to get the name of the author, couldn't, but it was in the June 2014 edition of Christianity Today, wrote this. When I was young growing up in the United Kingdom, my family and I could always count on our next door neighbor, Mrs. Ogilvy, to be around. We left a spare key with her in case we got locked out. We forgot our keys quite often, and she was always there, morning, afternoon, and night, to let us in. Mrs. Ogilvy never went out. She suffered from agoraphobia, the fear of open spaces. Having lived next door to her for 40 years now, I still haven't seen her venture past her doorway. She wasn't always this way. She has pictures on her mantelpiece of less anxious days from her honeymoon with Mr. Ogilvie and from a day at the beach with her children. But after her husband died, Mrs. Ogilvie began to isolate herself. As a child, I saw opportunity in this. Her garden resembled a jungle, and I earned some pocket money by pretending to be Indiana Jones, armed with a machete, slicing through the undergrowth, clearing the path to her door. As an adult, I can only imagine the heavy cloud of fear and frustration that surrounds her. Now frail and in the twilight of life, Mrs. Ogilvie's curtains are almost always drawn. But now and then, I still get locked out, and as she hands me the spare key, I'm glad to see that she is still alive. I see parables between Mrs. Ogilvie and the... I didn't advance that for you, did I? There we go. I see parables between Mrs. Ogilvie and the contemporary church. Many Christians observe the world from behind closed curtains, bemoaning culture instead of engaging it. Many local churches are isolated from the wider community and world, suffering from fear of an open public square with divergent viewpoints and lifestyles. Wow. Jesus' disciples are to be influential for the kingdom, even in the midst of an oppressive world. Salt and light can be understood to imply two aspects of witness to the world. Disciples, like salt, must mingle with the world in order to give it good flavor, to purify it, to preserve it. And disciples, like lamps, must remain distinct from the world in order to illuminate it. Salt is of no value if it loses its zing, and its zing is not to be kept inside of a salt shaker. Verses 17 through 20. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, these verses serve as the interpretive key for the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, our understanding of this particular section of the sermon is critical to our understanding this sermon as a whole. Jesus says in verse 17, "Don't assume that I came to destroy the law and the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill." Law and the prophets is Jesus' way of referring to the entire Old Testament. And he says that he didn't come to abolish the Old Testament, but to fulfill it. Jesus came to fulfill the intention of the Old Testament. That is, to bring it to its intended conclusion. And the fulfillment Jesus has in mind here in relation to the Old Testament is not simply external conformity to its commands, but rather a heart alive to God. That is what the law was calling for all along. Deuteronomy 30, verse 6 says, "In And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. To emphasize his belief in the scriptures, which corrected their implied misconception of how he viewed scripture, Christ spoke three important truths about scripture. Number one, the reliability of the scriptures. Until heaven and earth pass away, not one iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. No book has ever been so attacked like the Bible, yet no book has done as well in prospering as the Bible. Number two, the retribution from the scriptures. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Judgment will come upon those who break the laws of the word and who teach others to do the same, that we don't have to pay any attention. They're just of no value. You don't want to do that. Number three, the reward from the scriptures. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Both doing and teaching the word will result in great praise in heaven. What God calls great is seldom what a man calls great. Many famous athletes, movie stars, politicians called great here on earth will not be called great in heaven. It's only those who do and teach the word that will be called great in heaven. Verse 20. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, this is simply another way Jesus speaks about salvation. Jesus demands a righteousness exceeding that of the scribes and Pharisees. That reality ought to shock us. It's designed to. It should alert us that unless our righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, we will not enter the kingdom of heaven, but will remain forever in the kingdom of darkness. In other words, this righteousness is the difference between heaven and hell. Now, in light of these truths, we're left wondering what kind of righteousness the Pharisees had, given that our righteousness needs to exceed it. Although we could look at other passages for help with this question, Matthew 23, verses 25 through 28, really capture the kind of righteousness that the Pharisees had. Matthew 23, 25, Jesus says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but the inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence." Notice the contrast that Jesus draws between what is on the inside and what is on the outside. The Pharisees were clean on the outside, but they were full of greed and self-indulgence in their hearts. And the same is presented in the very next verse that followed. Verse 26 says, "You blind Pharisees, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside may also be clean." And then in verses 27 and 28, Jesus gives perhaps the clearest and the most picturesque illustration of this righteousness of the Pharisees. Verses 27 through 28. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which outwardly appear beautiful, but within are full of dread, people's bones, and all uncleanness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others, but within you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." And so the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees was purely an external righteousness. But Jesus says that it's not enough to be righteous merely on the outside. Ours has to exceed that kind of righteousness. What Jesus is demanding is not more righteous deeds by human effort, but more righteousness of hearts by divine grace. It's not saying that you must have a quantitatively greater righteousness, something like a righteousness that is numerically greater than the scribes or the Pharisees. You don't have to do more good works than them. To use an academic analogy, it's not that the Pharisees have scored in the low 90s on the holiness test. An entrance into the kingdom of heaven requires a score of 94, 95, or 96. This misses the point altogether. This is not an outer righteousness to show everyone how good we look, but an inner righteousness that shows how gracious and powerful God is. Jesus was saying that authentic spirituality needed a different kind of righteousness altogether. Out of love for God. Not just a more intense version of the Pharisees' obedience, which was mere legal compliance. Genuine righteousness must, number one, come from what God does in us, not what we do in and of ourselves. Number two, be God-centered, not self-centered. Number three, be based on reverence for God, not on approval from others. Number four, go beyond keeping the law to living by the principles behind the law. We should be just as concerned about our attitudes that people don't see as about our actions that will be seen. Is your faith genuine? Or is it an imitation? There's a lot that's riding on being truthful about your answer. Rob Smitty was a man who donated one of his kidneys to a total stranger. It was a noble, generous sacrifice. While browsing the internet, Smitty developed an interest in people needing organs. He said his motivation involved doing something that would make his children proud. But his 10-year-old daughter wasn't impressed by his sacrifice. Amber said her father never comes to see her, never calls, not even on her birthday. "I don't think he's much of a hero," she said. Tennessee records show Smitty had not made child support payments to Amber's mother in 9 months. Just as Amber is not impressed with her father's sacrifice, God is not impressed with our sacrifices that only imitate true spirituality that Christ spells out for us on the Sermon on the Mount. Do you have this inner purity that only Christ gives by inviting him in to your life to take control and to change you from the inside out? Have you invited Christ into your life? Maybe some time ago. But you're not allowing his righteousness and these kingdom truths to be seen by others, to be evident by others. Oh, that you'd make the correction today on that one. If you've never given your life to Christ and don't have that security of knowing that if you were to die today, you would live eternally with Christ forever in heaven, my encouragement is for you to pray to receive Christ to come in and take control of your life. And if you've done that and God is putting his finger on your life today, saying, "Now, why aren't these kingdom principles being shown in your life? How come you're not allowing me to express these things through you?" Today is a day to get honest with the Lord. Today is a day to come to him and say, Christ, I'm sorry. I've been sinning. Please forgive me. Let your light shine through me. I'm not going to resist it any longer. Would you pray?